the trademark Philopon Hiropon and later used by kamikaze pilots in the war. The drug was developed out of ephedrine, a natural substance that clears the bronchia, stimulates the heart, and inhibits the appetite. In the folk medicine of Europe, America, and Asia, ephedrine had been known for a long time as a component of the ephedra plant and was also used in so-called Mormon tea. Hauschild perfected the product, and in autumn 1937, he found a new method of synthesizing methamphetamine. A short time later, on October 31, 1937, the Temmler factory patented the first German methylamphetamine, which put American benzedrine very much in its shadow, its trademark, Pervitin. The molecular structure of this pioneering material is similar to adrenaline, and so it passes easily through the blood and into the brain. Unlike adrenaline, however, methamphetamine does not cause sudden rises in blood pressure, but works more gently and lasts longer. The effect occurs because the drug tickles out the messenger substances, dopamine and noradrenaline, from the nerve cells of the brain and pours them into synaptic gaps. This puts the brain cells in excited communication with each other, and a kind of chain reaction takes place. A neuronal firework explodes, and a biochemical machine gun starts firing an uninterrupted sequence of thoughts. All of a sudden, the consumer feels wide awake and experiences an increase in energy. The senses are intensified to the extreme. One feels livelier, energized to the tips of one's hair and fingers. Self-confidence rises. There is a subjectively perceived acceleration of thought processes, a sense of euphoria, and a feeling of lightness and freshness. A state of emergency is experienced, as when one faces a sudden danger, a time when an organism mobilizes all its forces, even though there is no danger, an artificial kick. Methamphetamine does not only pour neurotransmitters into the gaps, but also blocks their reabsorption. For this reason, the effects are long-lasting, often more than 12 hours, a length of time that can damage the nerve cells at higher doses as the intercellular energy supply is drawn into sympathy. The neurons run hot and brain chatter can't be turned off. Nerve cells give up and die off irrevocably. This can lead to a deterioration in the ability to find words, in attention and concentration, and a general depletion in the brain where memory, emotions, and the reward system are concerned. The lack of stimulation once the effect fades away is a sign of empty hormone stores, which have to fill up again over the course of several weeks. In the meantime, fewer neurotransmitters are available. The consequences can include a lack of drive, depression, joylessness, and cognitive disturbances. Although such possible side effects have been investigated by now, further in-depth research was put on the back burner at the time because Temmler was overeager, bursting with pride over their new product. The company smelled a roaring trade and contacted one of the most successful PR agencies in Berlin to commission an advertising campaign, the likes of which Germany had never seen. Their publicity model was the marketing strategy for another rather stimulating product, produced by none other than the Coca-Cola Company, which, with the catchy slogan, Ice Cold, had enjoyed enormous success with their brown brew. In the first weeks and months of 1938, when Pervitin was beginning to go from strength to strength, posters appeared on advertising pillars, the outsides of trams, and on the buses and local and underground trains of Berlin. In a modern, minimalist style, they mentioned only the trademark and referred to its medical indications, weakness of circulation, low energy, depression. It also showed the orange and blue Pervitin tube, the characteristic packaging with curved lettering. At the same time, another trick by this branch of business, all the doctors in Berlin received a letter from Temmler saying bluntly that the company's aim was to persuade the doctors personally. What people like themselves, they also like to recommend to others. The envelope included free pills containing 3 milligrams of active ingredient, as well as a franked postcard to be returned. Dear doctor, your experiences with Pervitin, even if they were less than favorable, are valuable to us in helping to limit the field of indication. so we would be very grateful to you for a message on this card. A substance in its test phase, just like the old dealer's trick, the first dose is free. Representatives of Temler visited large-scale practices, hospitals, and university clinics all over the country, delivered lectures, and distributed this new confidence and alertness-boosting drug. The company's own account said, "Reawakening joy in the despondent is one of the most valuable gifts that this new medication can give to patients. Even frigidity in women can easily be influenced with Pervitin tablets. The treatment technique is as simple as can be imagined. 4 half tablets every day, long before bedtime, 10 days a month for 3 months. This will achieve excellent results by increasing women's libido and sexual power." On the patient information leaflet, it also said that the substance compensated for the withdrawal effects of alcohol, cocaine, and even opiates. It was marketed as a kind of counter-drug to replace all drugs, particularly illegal ones. The consumption of this substance was sanctioned. Methamphetamine was regarded as a kind of panacea. The substance was also claimed to have a system-stabilizing component. "We live in an energy-tense time that demands higher performance and greater obligations from us than any time before," a senior hospital doctor wrote. "The pill, produced under industrial laboratory conditions in consistently pure quality, was supposed to help counteract inadequate performance and integrate shirkers, malingerers, defeatists, and whiners into the labor process." The Tübingen pharmacologist Felix Hafner even suggested the prescription of Pervitin as a supreme commandment, as it amounted to the last effort on behalf of the whole, a kind of chemical order. Germans, however, didn't need an order to take the buzzy substance. The hunger for powerful brain food was already there. Consumption wasn't decreed from above, and it wasn't top-down as you might have expected in a dictatorship. It was entirely bottom-up. This so-called speedamin landed like a bomb, spread like a virus, sold like sliced bread, and was soon as much of a fixture as a cup of coffee. Pervitin became a sensation, one psychologist reported. It soon gained acceptance in a very wide range of circles. Students used it as a survival strategy for the exertions of exams. Telephone switchboard operators and nurses swallowed it to get through the night shift, and people doing difficult physical or mental labor used it to improve their performance. Whether it was secretaries typing faster, actors refreshing themselves before their shows, writers using the stimulation of methamphetamine for all-nighters at the desk, or hopped-up workers on conveyor belts in the big factories raising their output, Pervitin spread among all social circles. Furniture packers packed more furniture. Firemen put out fires faster. Barbers cut hair more quickly. Night watchmen stopped sleeping on the job. Train drivers drove their trains without a word of complaint. And long-distance truck drivers bombed down freshly constructed autobahns, completing their trips in record time. Post-lunchtime naps became a thing of the past. Doctors treated themselves with it. Businessmen who had to rush from meeting to meeting pepped themselves up. Party members did the same, and so did the SS. Stress declined, sexual appetite increased, and motivation was artificially enhanced. A doctor wrote, "Experimenting on myself, I also observed that both physically and mentally one may receive a pleasant boost in energy, which for 6 months has allowed me to recommend Pervitin to manual and clerical workers, fellow colleagues who are temporarily short of time, and also speakers, singers with stage fright, and examination candidates. One lady likes to use the medication, see 2x2 tablets before parties, another successfully on particularly demanding working days, up to 3x2 tablets daily." Pervitin became a symptom of the developing performance society. Boxed chocolates spiked with methamphetamine were even put on the market. A good 14 milligrams of methamphetamine was included in each individual portion, almost 5x the amount in a Pervitin pill. "Hildebrand chocolates are always a delight," was the slogan of this potent confectionery. The recommendation was to eat between 3 and 9 of these, with the indication that they were, unlike caffeine, perfectly safe. The housework could be done in a trice, and this unusual tidbit would even melt the pounds away, since Pervitin, a slimming agent, also curbed the appetite. Another part of the highly effective campaign was an essay by Dr. Fritz Hauschild in the respected Klinische Wochenschrift. In this, and again in the same journal 3 weeks later, under the headline New Specialties, he reported on the extremely stimulating effect of Pervitin, its ability to increase energy and boost both self-confidence and decisiveness. Associative thought became much faster and physical work easier. Its multiple applications in internal and general medicine, surgery, and psychiatry seemed to give it a wide field of indication and at the same time to stimulate scientific research. Universities all over the Reich pounced on these investigations. First to engage was Professor Rudolf Schön from the Polyklinik in Leipzig, who reported psychic stimulation lasting for several hours, sleepiness and weariness disappearing and making way for activity, loquacity, and euphoria. Pervitin was fashionable among scientists, perhaps not least because at the start there was so much pleasure involved in taking it yourself. Self-experimentation was only common courtesy, after all. First of all, we may report on our personal experiences based on self-experimentation after repeated consumption of 3 to 5 tablets, 9 to 15 milligrams, of Pervitin, which were what enabled us to draw conclusions about its psychical effects. More and more advantages came to light. Possible side effects remained in the background. Professors Gerhard Lemmel and Jürgen Hartwig from the University in Königsberg testified to greater focus and concentration and advised, in these eventful times of conflict and expansion, it is one of the doctor's greatest tasks to maintain the performance of the individual and, where possible, to increase it. A study by 2 brain researchers from the southern town of Tübingen claimed they had demonstrated an acceleration of the thought process through Pervitin, along with a general increase in energy. Inhibitions of the decision-making process, inhibitions generally, and depressive conditions had been ameliorated. An intelligence test had demonstrated a distinct improvement. A Munich-based professor, C. Pullen, released data from many hundreds of cases supporting these statements. He reported a generally stimulating effect on the cerebrum, the circulation, and the autonomic nervous system. He had also, with a high dose of 20 milligrams administered once only, established a distinct reduction in fear. Hardly a surprise that Temmler should have supplied doctors with these positive results by mail and ensured that they were regularly updated. Pervitin was a perfect match for the spirit of the age. When the medication conquered the market, there actually seemed to be a reason for thinking that all forms of depression had come to an end. At least those Germans who profited from the Nazis' tyranny thought so, and that was most of them. If in 1933 many had still believed that the new chancellor's career would be short-lived and didn't think him capable of very much, a few years later everything looked very different. 2 miracles had occurred, one economic and one military, covering the 2 most urgent problems for Germany in the 1930s. When the Nazis took power, there were 6 million unemployed and only 100,000 poorly armed soldiers. By 1936, in spite of a continuing global crisis, almost full employment had been achieved, and the Wehrmacht was one of the most powerful military forces in Europe. Successes in foreign policy mounted up, whether it was a matter of the remilitarization of the Rhineland, the annexation of Austria, or bringing the Sudeten Germans home to the Reich. The Western powers did not punish these breaches of the Versailles Treaty. Quite the contrary, they made greater and greater concessions because they hoped to prevent a new war in Europe. But diplomatic successes didn't mollify Hitler. Like a morphine addict who can't give up his drug, he couldn't give up his plans for new seizures of power, new surprise attacks, secret marching orders, and grand parades, the historian Golo Mann wrote, describing the character of the emperor from Braunau. The Allies misjudged the situation. Hitler would not be mollified by diplomatic success. Hitler was never content. Boundaries had to be crossed in every respect and at all times, and state borders in particular. From the German Reich to the Greater German Reich to the planned Teutonic World Reich, the constant hike in doses was in the nature of the National Socialist cause, and this lay first and foremost in the hunger for new territories. The slogans, "Home to the Reich" and "The People Without Space," summed it up. Dr. Morell, the personal physician, was even directly involved with the defeat of Czechoslovakia. On the night of March 15, 1939, the Czech president, Emil Hacka, in poor health, attended a more or less compulsory state visit to the new Reich Chancellery. When he refused to sign a paper that the Germans laid in front of him, a de facto capitulation of his troops to the Wehrmacht, he suffered a heart attack and could no longer be spoken to. Hitler urgently summoned Morell, who hurried along with his case and his syringes, and injected the unconscious foreign guest with such a stimulating medication that Hacka rose again within seconds as if from the dead. He signed the piece of paper that sealed the temporary end of his state. The very next morning, Hitler invaded Prague without a fight. During the following years, Hacka sat at the powerless head of the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, to which parts of his country had been reduced, remaining Morell's loyal patient. In that respect, pharmacology worked as a way of continuing politics by other means. During those first months of 1939, the last months of peace, Hitler's popularity reached a temporary peak. "Look at everything this man has achieved," was a standard proclamation, and many of his countrymen also wanted to put their potential to the test. It was a time when effort seemed to reap rewards. It was also a time of social demands. You had to be part of it. You had to be successful, if only so as not to arouse suspicion. The general upturn also produced a concern that you might not be able to keep up with the new rapid pace. The increasingly schematic nature of work placed fresh demands on the individual, who became a cog in the works. Any help was welcome when it came to putting yourself in the mood, even chemical help. Pervitin made it easier for the individual to have access to the great excitement and self-treatment that had supposedly gripped the German people. The powerful stuff became a sort of grocery item, which even its manufacturer didn't want to keep stuck just in the medical section. "Germany awake," the Nazis had ordered. Methamphetamine made sure that the country stayed awake. Spurred on by a disastrous cocktail of propaganda and pharmaceutical substances, people became more and more dependent. The utopian ideal of a socially harmonized, conviction-based society, like the one preached by National Socialism, proved to be a delusion in terms of the competition of real economic interests in a modern high-performance society. Methamphetamine bridged the gaps, and the doping mentality spread into every corner of the Reich. Pervitin allowed the individual to function in the dictatorship. National Socialism in pill form. 2. Sieg Heil, 1939 to 1941. Music is sometimes really a great consolation to me, not forgetting Pervitin, which provides a wonderful service, particularly during air raids at night. Heinrich Boll. The man writing home from the front line to his parents was later a Nobel laureate for literature. He couldn't go without the wonderful service of methamphetamine, even after the war had ended and he was sitting back at his desk. He became dependent on it as a soldier in order to be able to endure the exertions of war and carry on functioning. Please remember to send me, at the next opportunity, an envelope containing Pervitin. Father can pay for it out of what he lost to me from our bet, he says in another letter from the war. Heinrich Boll speaks of his Pervitin consumption with a matter-of-factness that lets us conclude that he was aware of the effect, but not of the dangers. If next week goes as quickly as last, I'll be glad. Send me more Pervitin if you can. I can use it on my many watches, and a bit of bacon, if possible, to fry up with potatoes. His mentions of the upper, as short as they are frequent, suggest that his family was familiar with it and did not disapprove of its use. Dear parents and siblings, now I have time to write to you, and more importantly, the peace to do so. Of course I am dog-tired because last night I only slept for 2 hours, and tonight again I won't have more than 3 hours of sleep, but I've just got to stay awake. The Pervitin will soon start working, by the way, and help me over my tiredness. Outside, the moonlight is unusually bright. There's a clear, starry sky, and it's very cold. Again and again, sleep seems to be Bol's great adversary. I'm exhausted, and now I want to knock off. If possible, send me some more Pervitin and some Hilhal or Camille cigarettes. And elsewhere, duty is strict, and you must understand if in future I write only every 2 to 4 days. Today I'm mostly writing to ask for Pervitin. Is Heinrich Bol unique? Or did soldiers also engage in widespread substance abuse, as was happening in civil society? Were hundreds of thousands of German fighters waging their campaigns under the influence of methamphetamine? Did this addictive drug influence the course of the Second World War? A trip into the depths of the archives begins. Looking for clues at the military archive. The Bundesarchiv Militararchiv in Freiburg is surrounded by a barbed wire fence and guarded by a doorman with a strong Saxon accent. Anyone who can prove a genuine research interest will have the steel gates opened to him by photoelectric sensor and subsequently be drawn into the meticulously tidy study rooms. Their computers provide access to storerooms full of documents stacked from floor to ceiling. Millions of dead have left behind millions of files, and here is where you can research the drama of the wars that shook the 20th century. At least in theory. A lot has been stored, but navigating the clutter isn't easy. The headings of each folder only describe minimal aspects of its content. An additional complicating factor is that the keywords were chosen decades ago when researchers were focused on different areas. In the immediate post-war years, for example, less importance was placed on medical history details than today. Therefore, access to the past, although it is supported by the latest technology, is based on an outmoded understanding of history. The German army discovers a German drug. The rise of methamphetamine in the Wehrmacht is inseparably connected with an ascetic-looking senior staff doctor with a narrow face and dark brown eyes, which appear worryingly intense in the few photographs that survive of him. Professor Dr. Otto F. Ranke was 38 years old when he was appointed director of the Research Institute of Defense Physiology, a key position even though no one would have thought so at the time. Back then, physiology was a marginal discipline in medicine. A holistic approach toward understanding an organism, it treats the interactions between the physical and biochemical processes of cells, tissue, and organs. Defense physiology, in turn, dealt with the specific burdens of soldiers with the aim of boosting the performance of the army in the face of excessive demands and a stressful environment. The military was starting to see itself as a modern organization, and soldiers were described as animated engines. Ranke's task was to protect them against wear, meaning incapacity. He was to oil the cogs of the machine and functioned as a kind of performance coach for the German army, as well as a gadget inventor. Over the years, Ranke developed a sighting device for spotting artificial green, camouflage uniforms within a forest, for example, new anti-dust goggles for motorcyclists, tropical helmets that were both bulletproof and sweat-permeable for the Afrika Korps, and directional microphones to help the counterintelligence service listen in on its targets. Ranke's Research Institute of Defense Physiology was a section of the Military Medical Academy on Invalidenstrasse in Berlin. A large building in 18th-century neo-Baroque style, it is now home to the Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Energy. Curved gold letters read, Scientiae Humanitati Patriae, in a relief on the mansard roof above the main door. To science, to humanity, to the fatherland. From 1934 until 1945, this was where the army trained its rising medical officers. The Prussian elite institution, known as the MA for short, had the biggest medical and scientific library in Europe, and a two-story laboratory building fully equipped with the latest technology, several big auditoria, reading rooms, and a hall of honor with busts of Virchow, von Helmholtz, von Behring, and other doctors and researchers who had, it was said, each performed an immortal service for science. The complex also included the most modern gymnasiums and swimming pools, as well as a 5-story residential block with comfortable double rooms for the 800 trainee medical officers. These were known as Pfeifhane, a complex Berlin play on the word Pépin, a derivative of Pépinière, the former training institute for military doctors under the Prussian kings, which had turned out the cream of medical scientists in the 19th century. In their wake, the MA students confidently wore the Reich Eagle and the swastika on their smart uniforms. There was also a riding stable with 90 horses, several racing tracks, and nursing stables for sick horses, veterinary officers, and a smithy. The scientific departments were housed in the big block to the rear of the inner courtyard, the Institute for Pharmacology and Army Toxicology, the Laboratory for Serum Conservation, and the Aeronautical Medical Research Institute, directed by Professor Hubertus Schruckhold, who would pioneer American space travel after the war along with Wernher von Braun, as well as the Research Institute of Defense Physiology, run by Otto Ranke, which in 1938 consisted of only an additional auxiliary doctor, 3 medical interns, and a few civilian clerical staff. But the ambitious Ranke wanted to build up his department very quickly. He planned to do this through something he promoted for the Wehrmacht, a small molecule about to have a grand career. From brown bread to brain food. Ranke, the leading defense physiologist in the Third Reich, had one main enemy. It wasn't the Russians in the East or the French or the British in the West. The adversary he was determined to defeat was fatigue. A strange antagonist, hard to grasp, one that regularly knocked out fighters, put them on the ground, and forced them to rest. A sleeping soldier is a useless soldier, incapable of action. Fatigue causes your coordination to deteriorate. You fire randomly, and you lose the capacity to drive motorbikes, cars, or tanks. In Ranke's words, relaxing on the day of fighting can decide the battle. Often in combat, perseverance in that last quarter of an hour is essential. Ranke declared the war on exhaustion to be his main concern. In the spring of 1938, a year and a half before the outbreak of war, he read the Temmler pharmacist Hauschild's Hymn of Praise to Pervitin in the Klinische Wochenschrift, and his ears pricked up. A claim preyed on his mind. Supposedly this substance helped subjects achieve a 20% increase in lung capacity and absorb greater amounts of oxygen. Standard measurement parameters at the time for increased performance. He decided to explore the subject in depth, testing a rising number of medical officers, 90 at first, then 150. He organized voluntary blind tests, giving them Pervitin, P, caffeine, C, Benzedrin, B, or placebos, S for Scheintablette. Test subjects had to solve math and logic problems through the night until 4 p.m. the following day. The results seemed unambiguous. At around dawn, the S-men had their heads on their desks while the Pervitin gang were still manically working away, fresh-faced, physically and mentally alert, as the experimental record has it. Even after over 10 hours of constant concentration, they still felt that they wanted to party. But after the test sheets were evaluated, not all of Ranke's findings were positive. Procedures that demanded greater abstract achievements from the cerebellum were not performed well by consumers of Pervitin. Calculations might have been carried out more quickly, but they contained more mistakes. Neither was there any increase in capacity for concentration and attention during more complex questions, and there was only a very small increase during less high-level tasks. Pervitin kept people from sleeping, but it didn't make them any cleverer. Ranke concluded without a trace of cynicism that this made it ideal for soldiers, according to results gathered from what was probably the first systematic drug experiment in military history. An excellent substance for rousing a weary squad. We may grasp what far-reaching military significance it would have if we managed to remove natural tiredness using medical methods. a militarily valuable substance. Inspired by this result, Ranke suggested a larger series of tests be carried out on regular units. To his surprise, the request fell on deaf ears. In the Bendler Block Office Complex, the seat of the General Army Office, and today the Federal Ministry of Defense, the possibilities and dangers of the drug were ignored. While the ambitious scientist Ranke was already imagining the soldier of the future, whose equipment would also include synthetic alkaloids, which attacked the center of the brain in a way that wasn't yet understood, his superiors, military bureaucrats in the medical inspection unit, hadn't quite reached this level of sophistication. They were still wondering whether it was better to give the troops brown bread or white bread, while Ranke had long since moved on to brain food. He had predicted what the Berlin doctor and author Gottfried Benn, trained in the days of the Kaiser at the predecessor to the Military Medical Academy, wrote a few years later. Powerful brains are strengthened not with milk, but with alkaloids. Such a small organ, and so vulnerable, that has managed not only to comprehend pyramids and gamma rays, lions and icebergs, but to produce and to imagine them, cannot be watered with groundwater like a forget-me-not, not while there's so much that's already stagnant. Ben wrote this in his essay Provoked Life. The provocations are the changes in the neuronal streams, new thoughts, fresh ideas, sparked by unconventional food for the brain. Knowledge of Pervitin and its striking effects spread fast through the young medical officers. Under severe pressure in their difficult medical studies, they soon expected genuine miracles from the supposedly performance-enhancing substance and began to take more and more. This made them forerunners of the students of today at universities all over the world, among whom the use of performance pills like Ritalin and amphetamine derivatives is widespread. It was only when Ranke found out about this trend, which he had sparked in part with his tests, and learned that a room had had to be set out at Munich University for Pervitin corpses, fellow students who had overdosed and had to rest till they came around, that he became aware of the danger. He was forced to acknowledge that the consumption of high doses was already common in the run-up to exams at his military medical academy. The results from those under the influence left much to be desired, and a concerned colleague wrote, "In the cases in which an admission of drug assistance was made, the result of the examination was extraordinarily poor." Ranke hastily canceled another Pervitin experiment planned for 1939 and sent a letter to the other institute directors of the academy warning about possible dangers of addiction and urging them to forbid Pervitin completely at the academy. But Ranke couldn't get rid of the ghosts he had summoned up. Methamphetamine spread like wildfire and would pass through every barracks gate over the next weeks and months. The last few days of peace passed. The medical officers were preparing themselves for their approaching deployment in Poland and bought up everything in the pharmacy, as Pervitin wasn't officially supplied by the Wehrmacht, or at least not yet. Ranke could only look on. Less than a week before the start of the war, he wrote to a military general surgeon at high command. "Of course, it's a double-edged sword, giving the troops a different medicine which cannot be restricted to emergencies." The warnings came too late. An uncontrolled large-scale test began, without instructions as to the correct dosage of the upper, and supplied with huge quantities of it, the Wehrmacht fell upon its unsuspecting eastern neighbor. Robots. "I am the driver of a hospital train, and I'm often exposed to great stress. Your pills have proved their worth with both me and my staff. Difficulties seem easier to overcome. Now I am fresh again." The reports by the medical service on methamphetamine use in the attack on Poland, which began on September 1, 1939, and sparked the Second World War, fill whole dossiers in the Freiburg Military Archive. A jumble of garbled depictions, the records hold no claims to being complete or representative. But they were all that Ranke, who had been appointed advisory defense physiologist of the Army Medical Inspection Service at the beginning of the war, had to work on. There was no planned investigation, because the substance had not been deployed in a planned way, but randomly, according to the whim of the relevant commander, medical officer, or individual soldier. When crossing the Grand River Vistula in Poland, The 3rd Panzer Division swerved at Grudziądz in the direction of East Prussia and advanced from there toward Brest-Litovsk, reporting the following. Often there is euphoria, an increase in attention span, clear intensification of performance, work is achieved without difficulty, a pronounced alertness effect, and a feeling of freshness. Worked through the day, lifting of depression, returned to normal mood. War was seen as a task that needed to be worked through, and the drugs seemed to have helped the tank units not to worry too much about what they were doing in this foreign country, and instead let them get on with their job, even if the job meant killing. Everyone fresh and cheerful, excellent discipline, slight euphoria, and increased thirst for action. Mental encouragement, very stimulated. No accidents. Long-lasting effect. After taking 4 tablets, double vision and seeing colors. Even slight hallucinations, clearly perceived as pleasant, enchanted the men, soon to be heady with victory. The feeling of hunger subsides. One particularly beneficial aspect is the appearance of a vigorous urge to work. The effect is so clear that it cannot be based on imagination. One senior lieutenant reported on his own good experience of the substance. No side effects, no headache, no roaring in the ears, intellect wide awake. For 3 days and 3 nights, in a convivial mood, he engaged in negotiations with the Russians in Brest-Litovsk. It was a matter of dividing up the country. When he encountered Polish defenders on the way back, the methamphetamine put him particularly on the ball. For many soldiers, the drug seemed to be an ideal companion on the battlefield. It switched off inhibitions, which made fighting easier, whether it was night marches, before which the upper was consumed by all drivers and leaders at midnight to sharpen their attention, removing stuck tanks, shooting, or performing other automatized maneuvers. In every aspect of the attack, which led to the deaths of 100,000 Polish soldiers, and by the end of the year, 60,000 Polish civilians, the drug helped the aggressors to work without any sign of tiredness until the end of the mission. It provided that extra portion of energy which made everything that much easier. A medical officer from the 9th Army Corps raved, "I'm convinced that in big pushes, where the last drop has to be squeezed from the team, a unit supplied with Pervitin is superior. The doctor has therefore made sure that there is a supply of Pervitin in the unit medical equipment. An increase in performance is quite evident among tank drivers and gun operators in the long-lasting battles from 1 to 4 September 1939, and the reconnaissance division, which has used this substance with great success on tough long journeys at night, as well as to maintain and heighten attentiveness on scouting patrol operations," another report read. "We should particularly stress the excellent effect on the working capacity and mood among severely taxed officers at divisional headquarters, all of whom acknowledged the subjective and objective increase in performance with Pervitin." This heightened attention didn't only apply to tank drivers. One senior military doctor wrote, "Motorcyclists were expected to make quite enormous efforts in great heat, severely dusty conditions and on bad roads, on prolonged journeys which lasted from early in the morning until late in the evening, and from Silesia through Bohemia, Moravia and Slovakia, almost as far as Lemberg, Lviv, in Poland. The tablets were distributed without indication of their purpose, but their striking effects soon made it clear to the crews what purpose they were supposed to serve. Teutonic, easy riders, with drugs from Temmler and goggles by Ranke." If Pervitin was unavailable, it was assumed that the soldiers in question faced a greater threat. A senior staff medic reported regretfully, "Among the drivers, many accidents, mostly attributable to excessive fatigue, could have been avoided if an analeptic such as Pervitin had been administered. Crystal meth to avoid road accidents? Really?" There were critical voices, too. The army doctor for the 6th Army, which was later to perish at Stalingrad, assembled several reports from subordinate medical officers and wrote to Ranke, "These contradictory reports make it clear beyond any doubt that Pervitin is not a harmless medication. It does not seem at all appropriate for it to be handed out at random to the troops." So some people clearly held reservations about the use of this stimulant. Still, curiosity had been awakened. The concluding sentence of the report from the 4th Army Corps states, To continue the experiments, a larger quantity of Pervitin tablets is required. Burnout. Britain and France declared war on Germany on September 3, 1939, after the invasion of Poland. Initially, no shots were fired in the West. Instead, the adversaries watched each other, motionless, for months. No one wanted to fight. The shock of the First World War, with millions of soldiers slaughtered, was still lodged in the memory. Banners were hung at the front lines, "We won't shoot unless you shoot first." It would be wrong to speak of belligerence or nationalist pride on either side, unlike the situation in 1914. The Germans started the war, the historian Goloman writes, but they weren't keen on it. Not the civilians, not the soldiers, least of all the generals. One person saw things differently. Hitler wanted to attack France as quickly as possible, ideally in the autumn of 1939. But there was one problem. The Western Allies clearly had superior equipment and greater armed forces. Contrary to what Nazi propaganda told the outside world, the Germans did not have superior armies. Quite the opposite. After the Polish campaign, their equipment urgently had to be renewed. Most divisions had poor equipment, barely half of it suitable for use. The French army, on the other hand, was considered the strongest in the world, and Great Britain, through its global empire, had access to infinite resources for its war economy. The figures spoke volumes. On the German side, there were just 3 million soldiers, while the Allies had a good million more. In many categories, the Allies outclassed the Wehrmacht. A general rule of thumb in military strategy is that an attacker must be superior by 3-1 to be able to carry out a successful invasion. No wonder, then, that the Wehrmacht High Command struggled to devise a successful plan. Hitler refused to acknowledge these realities, and was convinced the Aryan warrior soul would achieve dominance against the odds. Again and again, mistakenly inspired by the military's doped performance on the Polish campaign, he spoke of miracles of courage of the German soldier. In fact, even the dictator was clueless. The French and British declaration of war had caught him off guard. Until the last moment, he had hoped the West would react to the invasion of Poland in the same way as it had reacted to the absorption of Czechoslovakia. But that was not the case. And suddenly, unprepared, Germany had to fight a war against the whole of Western Europe. Hitler had maneuvered the Reich into an impossible situation, and his back was against the wall. His chief of the general staff, Franz Halder, warned, "Time, generally speaking, will work against us if we don't exploit it as much as we can. Economic means on the other side are stronger." What was to be done? Apart from rashly facing his opponents down, Hitler had no ideas. The Wehrmacht High Command, given to sober mathematical planning, was horrified. The Bohemian Lance Corporal, with his erratic ideas and volatile intuitions, was not well enough thought of among the Prussian chiefs of the General Staff, and was often dismissed as a military dilettante. An inadequately prepared attack could only lead to another defeat, as in the First World War. So strongly was this felt that a coup was even planned against the dictator to prevent his rushing into war. Walter von Brauchitsch and Halder decided to arrest their Führer if he gave an order to attack. After Georg Elser's unsuccessful attempt on Hitler's life on November 8, 1939, in the Munich Bürger Braukeller, there was a general crackdown and tightening up of security, and these plans would be dropped. Then, in the autumn of 1939, a crucial meeting was held between two senior officers. They came up with a daring concept. Erich von Manstein, a 52-year-old general from Berlin with an irascible temperament and permanently flushed cheeks, had a discussion with an East Prussian tank general, Heinz Guderian. The Wehrmacht's only chance, they reasoned, might lie in pushing a lightning armada of tanks through the supposedly impassable Belgian Ardennes Mountains to reach the French border city of Sedan within a few days, and then charge all the way to the Atlantic coast. As the Allies were anticipating an attack farther to the north and were massing their forces there, such a Sichelschnitt, sickle cut was how Churchill later referred to it, might outsmart and encircle most of the defending forces. Among the German general staff, the foolhardy suggestion prompted only a shaking of heads. Tanks were still seen as ungainly monsters, which might come to the aid of other branches of the armed forces, but could not lead a moving attack in autonomously acting units, particularly through difficult mountainous terrain. The sketched invasion plan was seen as simply insane, and in order to thwart the risk-taking von Manstein, the general staff moved him to the Baltic port of Stettin, far from the potential battle zone. Hitler's chief of the general staff kept coming up with new excuses in response to Hitler's constant pressure to begin fighting. The bad weather alone was mentioned dozens of times as a reason for not attacking. The Wehrmacht Oberkommando argued that it only had what was called fine-weather weaponry, and it needed a cloudless sky for the Luftwaffe. So at first, the Western Front fell into an enchanted slumber. When Ranke visited the Baroque town of Zweibrücken, close to the border with Lorraine, anti-tank obstacles loomed, but the squaddies spent most of their time playing card games, smoking their cigarette rations, 7 a day, kicking footballs about, helping with the potato harvest, and practically lulling the French, only a few miles away, into a false sense of security with their peaceful bearing. But that didn't mean that the Germans weren't ready to switch to a different tempo at any moment. In their trouser pockets, they always had their pep pills at the ready. Ranke quickly established that a very large proportion of officers carries Pervitin on their person. The favorable effect was confirmed by all those asked, both motorized troops and members of other parts of the troops. They knew that the fighting could begin at any moment. When that happened, they had to be on top form and wide awake. No wonder they already practiced extensively with meth. Alarmed at its prophylactic use, Ranke wrote, "The question is not whether Pervitin should be introduced or not, but how to get its use back under control. Pervitin is being exploited on a mass scale without medical checks." He urged the introduction of guidelines and an instruction leaflet to regulate application of the drug and make the experiences of the East Polish campaign lessons for the West. However, none of these measures were enacted. How casually Pervitin was thought of and how widespread its use was is also apparent in the fact that Ranke himself took it regularly and freely reported the fact in his wartime medical diary as well as in letters. He eased an average working day with 2 Temler tablets, using them to overcome his work-related stress and improve his mood. Even though he knew about the dangers of dependency, he, the self-appointed expert on Pervitin, drew no conclusions about his own use of the substance. For him, it remained a medication that he took in whatever quantities he saw fit. If he experienced side effects, he did not acknowledge them as such, but deluded himself. In spite of Pervitin, from 11 o'clock in the morning I increasingly suffer from headaches and digestive problems, he wrote bluntly to a colleague, "It distinctly revives concentration and leads to a feeling of relief with regard to approaching difficult tasks. It is not just a stimulant, but clearly also a mood enhancer. Even at high doses, lasting damage is not apparent. With Pervitin, you can go on working for 36 to 50 hours without feeling any noticeable fatigue." Staying awake for 2 days and 2 nights in a row became the norm for the defense physiologist. He constantly worked at high speed during the first few months of the war. Between the front, where he delivered lectures on Pervitin, and the capital, where he was enlarging his institute, he found no time to rest. His workload was getting too much for him, and he took the drug more and more regularly so as not to fall behind in his performance. It was not long before Ranke was on the brink of a classic case of burnout, though the term didn't yet exist. In his diary, he reported bravely, "Personal matter, my depression has been overcome. I've been ready for work again since midday on 8/11. But often he only went to bed very late at night, where he spent an abundantly sleepless night and complained the following day, nearly collapsed." His slow descent into dependency is exemplary. He tried to use chemicals to keep pushing against his own limits, even when he was completely exhausted. It didn't always work. 1911-39. General inability to work under the pressure of imminent discussion and inspection. Ranke wasn't the only one squashed between the stress of war and Pervitin consumption. His correspondence from those days shows that more and more officers were using the drug to keep up with their duties. Outside of the military, the addiction was also growing. In 1939, Pervitin fever was rife in the Third Reich. Whether it was housewives going through menopause who wolfed down the stuff like sweets, young mothers who took methamphetamine to ward off the baby blues, or widows who were looking for elite partners through the marriage bureau and who took high doses to combat inhibitions during their first meeting. To help with childbirth, to fight seasickness, vertigo, hay fever, schizophrenia, anxiety neuroses, depressions, low drive, disturbances of the brain. Wherever the Germans hurt, the blue, white, and red tube was at the ready. As coffee had hardly been available since the start of the war, methamphetamine was often added as a substitute to pep up ersatz versions of the drink. Pervitin could, rather than being pumped into bomber pilots and bunker pioneers, be used deliberately for cerebral machinations in higher education colleges, Gottfried Benn wrote of these times. It may sound deviant to some people, but it is only the natural continuation of an idea of humanity's progress. Whether it is rhythm, drugs, or modern autogenic training, it is the ancient human desire to overcome tensions that have become unbearable. In late autumn 1939, the Reich Health Office reacted to this trend, which could be overlooked no longer. Leo Conti, the Reich Health Führer, tried to prevent, however belatedly, an entire nation becoming addicted to drugs. He pointed out that the disturbing after-effects fully obliterate the entirely favorable success achieved after use. To toughen the legal situation, he approached the Justice Ministry and expressed his concern that the emergence of a tolerance to Pervitin could paralyze whole sections of the population. Anyone who seeks to eliminate fatigue with Pervitin can be quite sure that it will lead to a creeping depletion of physical and psychological performance reserves, and finally to a complete breakdown. In a personal proclamation, he appealed in a typical Nazi manner to all honorary affiliates in the battle against drugs. The serious nature of the times should forbid all German men and women from devoting themselves to questionable pleasures. The personal example of the rejection of drugs is more necessary and appropriate today than it has been in the past. I ask you to help, through your work, to protect and strengthen German family life where it is threatened by the use of drugs. By doing so, you will increase the inner resilience of our people. In November 1939, Conti made Pervitin available on prescription only in every case, and a few weeks later delivered a speech in the Rathaus in Berlin to members of the National Socialist German Association of Doctors, warning against the big new threat of addiction with all its side effects, which faces us all. But his words were not taken seriously, and consumption continued to rise. Many pharmacists stuck only loosely to the new prescription regulation and even gave their customers hospital packs of the drug without prescription. It was still easy for a citizen to get hold of several Pervitin ampules or hundreds of pills from pharmacies every day. This was also true of soldiers. The regulation concerning prescriptions applied only to civilian society and not to the military. But Conti also had the military in his sights. A war on drugs was waged against the background of the real war when the Reich Health Führer challenged the Wehrmacht to take a position on the use and abuse of drugs and its possible damage, as he had observed that our young soldiers look extraordinarily ill, often gray and sunken-cheeked. But Conti's Reich Health Office was a civilian authority, and the military promptly resisted his interference. The Wehrmacht cannot renounce a temporary increase in performance or a defeat of fatigue, even through the use of medication, Army Medical Inspector Anton Waldmann wrote back, coolly and clearly. On February 17, 1940, the same day as Conti wrote his letter of protest to the Army Medical Authority, there was a fateful meeting between Hitler and the generals Erich von Manstein and Erwin Rommel, who had recently been appointed commander of a panzer division. Manstein, hands plunged deep in his pockets as always, was able to set out in great detail his risky plan of attack, which no one at senior command was willing to hear. But Hitler, who was known for constantly interrupting his generals, listened spellbound as Manstein delivered his lecture about how he wanted to push through an impossible region of forested crags to wrongfoot the French and the British. Although Hitler couldn't stand the general, with his brazenly arrogant way of displaying his military expertise, certainly a very clever mind with operational gifts, but I don't trust him, he was immediately convinced by his surprise-based strategy. The success of the operation would depend on time, speed, and a daring idea, not just equipment. The material inferiority of the Germans suddenly didn't need to hinder an attack. Hitler didn't hesitate, clutching at this last straw. The Führer gave his agreement to these propositions. A short time later, the new and definitive deployment instruction was issued.